we're going to continue on. Can everybody hear me? Is this on, right? We're going to continue on with our study of comparing the four Gospels. We talked about Matthew last time, and so we want to go on a little bit with Mark. And just as some review, I have this. We talked about what the word gospel means, that it means the good news, and that, in fact, there really is only one gospel, even though we call the first four books the four gospels. There's only one real good news. It's just given from kind of four different viewpoints. If we look at these four books, or the four gospels, the first three, if you remember, were called synoptic gospels. That's a man's term, but it's a pretty decent term. It means seeing together, the synoptic gospels. And that's because the first three gospels have a lot in common. They are very similar, and as opposed to the fourth book, which I'll probably do in two installments, I would imagine, now that I'm thinking about it, John, which was 92% unique. These are uniqueness on the sides here. And so Matthew and Luke are fairly unique, and we talked about a lot of things that were only in Matthew that you couldn't find in the other Gospels. But you'll notice that tonight we're talking about Mark, and it's 7% unique. So that's supposed to mean that usually it's a shorter talk, but this morning in Martinsdale didn't turn out to be. So we're going to talk a little bit about Mark, but really we're going to focus on who this author is, mostly. And the reason that we talked about Matthew first last time is because it's the first book. And but it's not necessarily, I don't believe, the first written book. I think Mark probably is the first book that was written down. Matthew was canonized into the scriptures by God. God canonized the scriptures. That means that God put the books into the Bible in the order that he wanted. And that's what we have faith in. I hope we have faith in that. And God chose Matthew to be first, which is a wise decision. Because if you remember from Matthew, the whole key of Matthew was, who was it written to? Shouldn't ask questions about a past lesson, but the Jews, right? And it was a logical argument. If you go all the way through Matthew, it was a logical argument on that which was to be fulfilled, right? That Christ was the fulfillment of all the old prophecies that the Jews knew about, and Matthew went through a logical proof that that was the case. And so that was why it was a good thing to have Matthew be the first book in the New Testament, even though it probably wasn't the first book written. If we go look at, I think I want to just turn there real quick. Mark, the first verse in Mark, I think it tells us something that is, we probably skip over a lot, but it's important. It says, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The beginning of the gospel. And I think that's probably true. I think that Mark was probably the first gospel that had been written down. And we see that Mark's only 7% unique because, not because of all of it that might be in John, basically all of Mark is found in Luke or in Matthew. In some passages, the entire passage, word for word, is found in the books of Luke and Matthew. I believe Luke and Matthew heavily drew from the book of Mark. And there's passages where you can go to where it just looks like that pretty much that's they got that from Mark because it's exactly the same way that Mark wrote it. So there's very few things that I can show you in the book of Mark that we can't go find in Matthew and Luke also. Shouldn't be surprising, I don't think, really, because Luke actually says that he did this in his first chapter. We get to Luke. Luke says, I went and I researched this. I went and I talked to the eyewitnesses, which would generally be the apostles. We know that Mark is not one of the apostles, but Matthew clearly is. So Matthew would have known a lot of these things. But I think he probably took a lot from Mark too. And I'll tell you a little bit more why I think that that it makes a lot of sense that they probably drew some of their stuff from Mark. Not all of it. I mean, clearly they have a lot of unique material, but they took some of their things from Mark. So let's talk about who this Mark person is. Who is this Mark person? Sometimes he kind of goes by a little longer name. John Mark, right? And we know that we have all of these Gospels, with the exception, I guess, of Luke, because Luke actually refers to himself in the book. They don't say that, you know, I am Mark and I am writing it. I am John Mark, I'm writing this book. They don't say things like that. But you have the old ancient Greek manuscripts that there's a subtitle up above the title of Mark, and it will say according to, and then it has this name, this Mark name. And then if we go and read through the Bible, hopefully, I think a lot of times, we can probably piece together who it is. We were talking this morning at Martinsville. There's only two books in the New Testament that don't have in the first verse who it's really written by, with the exception, I guess, of Matthew and Mark and things. But Hebrews, we don't really quite know. And, of course, 2 John also does it, but we kind of have an idea who 2 John was written by. Hebrews, we're not quite sure. But I believe that this Mark, according to Mark, is probably John Mark. And we have 10 references to John Mark in the New Testament. I want to go over them. Like I said, most of what we're going to talk about is actually John Mark and who he was and kind of what his relationship was with other people. And we'll eventually kind of look at some of the unique things that are in the book of Mark. The first place that we find John Mark is in Acts chapter 12. And if I'm going to be there for a while, so if you'd like to go to that chapter. Acts chapter 12 and verse 12. And just to give you kind of a little foreplot of this verse. This is when there was King Herod. And King Herod had taken some people captive, and he had actually killed an apostle. Who was the first apostle that was murdered? James, right? And Herod had done that. And this was the brother of John, right? And he was the first one that had been killed. And Herod found that it pleased the Jews to do this. So he went and he captured who also? Peter. And if you're going to please the Jews by killing some of the apostles, these are probably the first two you're going to, or you'd probably maybe try to get John too. I don't know if he tried to do that or not. He got John's brother. But he then goes and he gets Peter too, who of course was in the inner circle, was a pillar of the early church, and of course a pillar of the apostles too. And he takes Peter and puts him in prison. If you remember this story, it's a really good story. He was in this jail cell late at night. He was under guard, 16 guards that he was under. And an angel came in the middle of the night, and the whole jail cell lit up. And it says that in verse 5, I want to kind of go back to 5 first. It says, "So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him." So we're in Jerusalem. We're talking about the Church of Jerusalem. And I want to kind of talk about a little bit about where the Church of Jerusalem met. I think we can do some speculation and kind of maybe get a decent idea of where this church was meeting. We see that this church was meeting together and was earnestly praying to God for him. And the angel leads him out and it says it led him down a full length of the street. And then Peter kind of came to himself. Peter kind of felt like that it was a dream that he was in, and then all of a sudden he realized, this isn't a dream, I escaped, I'm out, I made it. And so it's interesting where Peter goes. If we go down to verse 12 then, it says, "When this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark." He actually goes to John Mark's house. Now it's Mary's house. Apparently, if we're mentioning this being the house of Mary, John Mark probably is fairly young still, a young man, probably in this case. Normally, if you're going to talk to someone's house, you'd actually give the name of the man that owned the house. They don't say that here, and I'm not sure why. I don't know if necessarily that this person is the husband of Mary, maybe he's already passed on, or what the deal is there. We'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later. But it's John Mark's house, John Mark's mother's house. And it says that when he goes there, this is a really TV-made movie, I think, that you could make here. It says, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. Right? Well, we just talked about that the people were together, they were praying. They called it the church, right? I really tend to think that this probably is where this church in Jerusalem was meeting. In Mary's house, who was the mother of John Mark. And Peter goes there directly after he gets out of jail. And he goes there for some specific reasons. It's kind of a warning that I am out. And it says, Peter knocked on the outer entrance, which is interesting. There's kind of like a compound. There's an inner house, and there's an
outer entrance. And a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer the door. When she recognized Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed she ran back without opening it and exclaimed, "Peter is at the door." "You're out of your mind," they told her. When she kept insisting that it was so, they said, "It must be his angel." Then Peter kept on knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. Peter motioned with his hand for them to be quiet and described how the Lord had brought him out of prison. "Tell James and the brothers about this," he said, and then he left for another place. It's interesting. It doesn't even seem like he actually went in to the house. He was just there at the outer gate warning them about, I'm out, I made it out, I'm okay. And then he goes to another place. And he says, go in and tell James and the brothers. And I think this brothers is in reference to Jesus' brothers. Remember, Jesus' brothers at the beginning didn't accept him, right? Go up to Jerusalem, show yourself if you want to be well known. Well, by this time, we know that the brothers had accepted, and that they were part of the elders and the inner circle with at this time. And so Peter tells them to go in and tell James and the brothers about this, and he goes to a different place. And I think it's probably, could be a couple reasons. We know Peter was married, right? So maybe he was just going home to his wife. Or he was going somewhere else because, Peter had just escaped and there were 16 soldiers that he was under. Someone's going to pay the price for this. And we know that 16 soldiers ended up paying the price, but you know, it could have been very well that Peter was just protecting the church and these people and going to another place so that they didn't come and find Peter there and think, well, these people were the ones that broke him out or something like this. And so that could be another reason why he didn't stay with the church there. He goes on to somewhere else. But anyway, there's it's interesting that this house is the house of Mary. It's and this is John Mark's mother. And so I want to go a little bit further with this. I like to speculate. I know some of you don't like to do that, and some of you don't like when I do it. But I want to try to do it anyway for a little bit. The one thing I like about speculation is that I never have to speculate about the truth. I never have to speculate about what the plan is, what the gospel is, what the plan of salvation is. That's set in stone, and it's in every single gospel. But there are a lot of things that I find interesting on who this person is and what their relationship is, and I see nothing wrong with speculation on some of those things. Because I can say in the end, you can agree with what I think about this, or you don't have to. And we're brothers, and we can be happy with each other. So, I have always had this inkling that I'm very intrigued by, you know, Peter went to this place. And I'm like, why did he go there? And he goes, clearly it looks like in the earlier part of that chapter, that's where the church was, it looks like. And if it was indeed where the church was, then I think it's not a big stretch at all to assume that this John Mark's house, or Mary's house, was the upper room. And the reason I think this is because I really feel that the Church of Jerusalem continued to meet in the upper room. And if I think that in this Acts 12 that the church seems like they were meeting in this house, then I would automatically say that the upper room is probably this house of John Mark. And here's why I kind of think it. If we go back a little bit, we'll go back to Acts chapter 2 first. And I'll just kind of give you my logic on it, and then you can tell me I'm full of it. So we go to Acts chapter 2, and of course, there's a lot of things that happened in the upper room that we know happened in the upper room, right? What happened in the upper room in Acts chapter 2? What happened in Acts chapter 2? It's the beginning of the church, right? In Acts chapter 2, that's where they received the Holy Spirit, right? And it doesn't necessarily say the upper room, but it says, when the day of Pentecost came, they were all together in one place. And then it talks about the suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. Okay, so where are they? They're all in this house. Where are they? Well, we just kind of take it back a little bit further, right? Let's go back to chapter 1, in verse 10 through 14. It says, they're out and they're watching Jesus ascend into heaven. I'm going to get back to John and Mark eventually. They were looking intently up into the sky as he was going, when suddenly two men dressed in white stood beside them. "Men of Galilee," they said, "why do you stand here looking into the sky? This same Jesus who has been taken from you into heaven will come back in the same way you have seen him go into heaven." Then they returned to Jerusalem from the hill called the Mount of Olives, a Sabbath day walk from the city. When they arrived, they went upstairs to the room where they were staying. And the people present were the disciples. And they, it says that they all joined together constantly in prayer, along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. Now, why did they go back to Jerusalem, back to this place? Who had told them to go back there before he ascended? Jesus told them to go. Jesus said, you go back and you stay in Jerusalem until I send you what? The Holy Ghost, right? This has been probably 40 days or so. Remember, Jesus was had risen up, and he'd been present for many days in this. We know it's 50 days from when he was crucified with the Passover, but we have him being seen by a whole bunch of people, and they're still here. They're still at this place, right? And so how did they get to this place? We go to Acts 2, now we go to Acts 1. We go a little bit further about how did they originally get to this place. And if we go to Mark chapter 14, and this is important while we're going to get back to Mark here. And in chapter 14, we have two instances that I think are pretty interesting. One is completely unique to Mark. Mark chapter 14. We're trying to take this church, this house, and taking it all the way back as far as we can go to figure out how they originally got there. We're pretty sure the upper room was definitely Acts 2 and Acts 1. I think it's probably the same place for Acts 12 where the church was meeting. But if you remember how they got there originally, we go to Mark chapter 14, 13 through 15. And this passage here that we're going to read is in Matthew and it is in Luke, which makes sense. Okay? It's not in John, but it's in Matthew and it's in Luke. And Matthew and Luke drew heavily from Mark. But we have this story of this young man. And Matthew doesn't include that part. So Mark, this young man is original for Mark. And then Luke, according to his research, when he found out other people that were eyewitnesses, he took that from Mark and include that in Luke. So we do have that in Luke also. But this is Jesus, and they're coming into Jerusalem. And he says, so he sent two of his disciples telling them, go into the city. And a man, and it doesn't say young man, I think it is a young man, I can prove that here in a little bit. Go into the city and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. Say to the owner of the house that he enters, the teacher asks, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large upper room, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there. Now that is always intrigued. I get really intrigued by strange verses. I think that not that other people maybe not be intrigued by. But, you know, the disciples said, where should we take the Passover? Jesus says, go to this certain house. You will see this man carrying water, jars of water. Follow him into the house that he goes into. Talk to the owner of the house to say that the teacher is coming. The upper room is ready. It's ready to go. Who were these people? Who was this house? Was this someone that Jesus knew? Seems like it kind of would have to be. Someone that was a follower of the way. Someone that knew about Jesus, knew of his teachings. I'm not sure exactly, but it seems like clearly this house was someone that knew of Jesus and his teachings. And so who is this man carrying water? Well, it's interesting that he's carrying water, first of all. Right? This is a man that seems to live in this house, but he's not the owner, right? In this time, it sounds like the owner is a man. So maybe if this is Mary's house or John Mark's house, that the father is still alive, maybe. I don't know. Because there's other situations in family life where it could be a brother or somebody else that has taken them in, and that would be a lot of speculation. So I don't know exactly who this owner is. But I wonder if this man carrying the water is John Mark. And the reason I wonder that is because I feel that he's definitely a young man. Number one, because he's a man that's living in the house, but he's not the owner. So that would mean that he's not the patriarch or the kind of leader of the house. He's probably a younger person. But the other one that I think really lends credence to him being a young man is that what is he doing? Anybody knows what he's doing? What is he carrying? Water. He was carrying water, a water jar, going to get water probably at the well. How many men do you have examples of that happening in the scriptures? When that happens, who is it? It's a woman. How many times did Jesus, you know, meet the women at the well that they were carrying the water? This was considered at this time woman's work to be doing this. Well, it could also very well then be considered, just like it is today, chores for younger people, right? There would be absolutely no problem with this man going and getting the jars of water, if it was a young man doing this work, especially if it was for his mother and if his father wasn't around anymore and this man is somebody, the owner of the house, somebody else, I don't know about that, but I wonder if this is John Mark. And here's kind of why I wonder. Because we have another passage. If we go to the end of this chapter, it's in the same chapter, and we go to 51 through 52, and I think probably everybody here remembers this story. But not everybody here might realize that the only place you find this story is in the book of Mark. John Mark is the only person that records this particular story at the end of this chapter. And it's very interesting. It says, if I can see, it says, a young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. Now, what is this story? Where is this happening? This is out in the garden, right? If you remember, they had the Last Supper in the upper room. And then later that evening, Jesus went out to the garden with all his apostles, right? And that's the record we have in the other records, that he went out with his apostles. In the middle of the night, this is in the middle of the night, in the garden, and Jesus is grieving. He's weeping. He's praying to his Father. And the apostles are doing what? Sleeping. Non-stop sleeping. Jesus keeps waking him up. Can't you stay awake with me during my hour of grief? In this one passage here, when it says that Judas had already left, and he went and got the Jews in the middle of the night, and the Jews come, and what does Jesus say right before this happens? Jesus says, I preach daily in the temple, and you couldn't take me during the day. You come to me in the middle of the night to take me. How cowardly. And it says, all the disciples, it says that in verse 50, then everyone deserted him and fled. But then we have this very unique story about this young man that for some reason, in the middle of the night, was out in this garden. Why was he there? Why was he there? It seems very strange. But I don't think it's a big jump that if this church that was meeting in this house, in this upper room, was Mary's house, and Mary's son was John Mark, and this was the same young man that earlier in the day had went and got the water from the well to bring into the house to prepare for this feast, that it very well could have been the same person that was curious about what was happening here. And as the disciples and Jesus go out and leave and go out to the garden, that he followed them out there. Clearly, there's a young man here that's curious about what's going on. We know that. And he is out here in the garden, and they try to even capture him. We know that, at least, thanks to Mark. He's the only person that tells us about this. And if it is him, if it is John Mark, who better to know that story, right? We talked in Matthew about Matthew talking about himself, referring to him as a tax collector, and saying some things that the other people never said about him. It would make sense that John Mark here tells us this story about him as a young man out here in the garden with them. It wasn't just the apostles. It was this other young man here also. All that is complete speculation. You don't have to believe any of it. But it seems to me that that makes some logical sense. That this house probably could have been the upper room house where the early church met. And that this is how John Mark was kind of in the know about some of these events and things. But he is a young man, and we kind of know that later from some of the other passages. Okay, so that was the first one, and that's the longest one. We're going to go on to some other ones here. Acts 12 and 25, it says, and Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem, because remember they had went to Jerusalem to figure out about how we're going to handle the Gentiles, and the elders told them, well, this is what you're going to do. They're going to abstain from fornication and meat offered to idols and things like this. And when they were in Jerusalem, it says that they had fulfilled their ministry. They took with them John, whose surname was Mark. We know John Mark's a resident of Jerusalem. We just had the verse that was the house where Peter had, when he escaped from prison, had come there. And so Barnabas and Saul take John Mark on their first journey. A lot of you know this story, right? How long does John Mark last? Well, he lasts till the next chapter, right? Chapter 13, they're on the journey, and in verse 5, and when they were at Salamis, they preached the word of God in the synagogues of the Jews, and they had also John, their minister, so there's another mention of his name, one of the ten. And then skip down to verse 13. Now when Paul and his company loosed from Paphos, they came to Perga in Pamphylia, and John, departing from them, returned to Jerusalem. Why did he do that? Well, that's the problem you have when you have people that will just read only certain passages and not go to other passages to find out things. From this passage, you don't really know. He leaves them, and he goes back to Jerusalem, probably back to his mother's house. Why does he leave? It doesn't sound like there's any ill feeling here. But was there ill feeling here? There is ill feeling here. There's a problem. John abandons them on this journey. They had plans for John to be a fellow minister with them, and he leaves. And it's not under good circumstances, because we can go to Acts chapter 15, 37 through 39. And Barnabas determined they were going to go back out on their next journey. Barnabas determined to take with them John, whose surname was Mark. Barnabas was a good guy, wasn't he? What's his name mean? The son of encouragement, right? He took Paul when no one wanted anything to do with Paul. Barnabas took Paul under his wing. Barnabas wants to give John Mark another chance here. Probably for maybe a couple other reasons besides him being a son of encouragement, which we'll get to in a second. But Paul thought not good to take him with them, who departed from them from Pamphylia and went not with them to the work. And verse 39 is a very sad verse. And the contention was so sharp between them that they departed asunder, one from the other. And so Barnabas took Mark and sailed into Cyprus. That's a sad verse. You know, just because we're in the church, do we always all get along all the time? There's disagreements and there's contention, and it's a sad day when that happens. But it happens even to the best of people. With Paul and Barnabas, there was a contention so sharp that they separated from each other. That's sad. And Paul took Barnabas under, Barnabas took Paul under his wing. And now John Mark is in the same situation, or maybe not as in a bad of a situation as Paul was. You know, I think Barnabas probably handles things a lot better than I would. But I would have probably been, oh, well, boy, how great were you when I took you? No one else would take you. And John Mark is a young man. He made a mistake. We should take him. He can bring good to the word of the Lord. But it was contention, and they separated from each other at this particular place. But this is how the Holy Spirit works. Does good come out of this contention? Now we have twice as many people going to twice as many people, right? Spreading the word. Paul takes Silas and Barnabas takes Mark. And we don't hear a whole lot about Barnabas and Mark's journey, but I think there was a lot of good things that came out of Barnabas and Mark's journey. We know that Mark has changed his ways. We get to Colossians 4:10. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, saluteth you, and Marcus, sister's son to Barnabas. Whoa, that's an interesting passage. Now we have another connection. Marcus's mother, Mary, which we had in Acts 12, right? That had the house where Peter came to, was whose sister? Barnabas' sister. In different translations, you might see a word cousin, but it's relationships are very difficult to kind of understand on this, because cousin could mean what I think it means here, nephew. Sometimes son means grandson. It's kind of difficult. But in this translation, it says sister's son to Barnabas. So Barnabas was Mary's brother, which really leans to a lot of speculation. It could be very interesting. That house, that upper room where the church met, could have been Barnabas's house. I don't know. Could have been. If Mary's husband was now dead, it could have been easily for Barnabas to take her and her son, his nephew, who he was definitely close with. I think this is a big reason why Barnabas wanted to take John Mark with him. It could have been Barnabas' house. I don't know if it is or not, but it very well could have been. Barnabas could have been the owner, the leader of the patriarch of that house that the church was meeting in. I'm not sure. And then we get to one of my favorite verses that I am so thankful is in the Bible. 2 Timothy 4:11. This is a letter to Timothy from Paul, and it's one of the some of the last words that Paul says. Paul is giving up. He's fought the good fight, right? His life is soon to be over, and these are some of the last words he says. And what does he say? He says, "Only Luke is with me. Take Mark and bring him with thee, for he is profitable to me for the ministry." That is a good verse. Mark, I've changed my views on Mark. At one time, it was made me so angry that I separated from Barnabas over him. But you know, this is a good lesson for us. If we're in the Lord, and we have fellow relatives, not just physical family, but spiritual family as we have here, how they can help us, right? Are we always going to be perfect? Are we going to have problems? We are. But this is what the church does. The church can restore you. The church can help you with your walk. It's important to remember this. Clearly, Mark had some issues when he abandoned them on the first time around. I think that's pretty obvious. But clearly, Mark has turned around. Someone has helped Mark. Probably Barnabas. I think probably Peter had a lot to do with Mark, as we'll talk about here in a little bit. But Mark has changed, and Paul admits it. Freely admits it. Bring Mark. He is of great help to me. So he's about ready to give up his life, and he wants Mark there with him. Very significant. We go to Philemon 1, 23 and 24. There salute thee Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, Marcus, Aristarchus, Demas, Lucas, my fellow laborers. And then we get to 1 Peter 5:13. This is the last passage. There's 10 passages that list John Mark, and this is the last one. It's really significant because the first passage dealt with Peter also. The last one does also. And boy, the commentaries really like to speculate on this verse. I think it's way too out of bounds speculation. But what does Peter say? It's interesting. The church that is at Babylon, which I think is Rome, I think Peter's in Rome at this time, close to the end of his life also, elected together with you, saluted you, and so doth Marcus, my son. Peter calls Mark, John Mark, his son, and it seems like John Mark is with Peter here also in Rome, probably around the same time that he had been with Paul. Marcus, John Mark, my son. Well, I don't read anything into that. If we're going to read stuff into that, then we're going to say that Timothy was whose son? Paul's son, right? Doesn't Paul use the same language? And we have that language in the New Testament. So, is John Mark actually Peter's son? There's a lot of people out there I found out that think so. I totally do not think so. I think this is but I do believe this verse gives us a lot of insight. There is a father-son spiritual relationship with Peter and John Mark. I'm not sure, we don't have a lot of how that developed, but we know that Peter, when he got out of prison, went to John Mark's house. We know that. We know that the church probably was meeting there in the house. Peter was an elder of this church. And we know that when John Mark left Paul and Barnabas, he went back to Jerusalem, where Peter would have been. And so, I don't know, somewhere in there was a real relationship, a spiritual, probably mentoring relationship that was built between Peter and Mark, so that when we get to the end here, the very last time John Mark's mentioned, Peter is calling him my son. He calls him my son. And this is, I think, pretty important, that there's a strong relationship here with John Mark. And the reason I think that it's really significant and important that Mark has this really deep relationship, spiritual relationship with Peter, is, you know, if you were to read all four of the Gospels, and you just read through them, but you couldn't see the titles, you didn't know who they were read, and you didn't read the first couple verses of Luke that says that it's Luke, you know, who would you guess? And if someone told you there's four different writers that wrote these four books, read them, and then you tell me who wrote them. That might be kind of hard to do, but who would you guess? Who would you think that would be able to know the most to be able to write those four stories of Jesus? Peter probably, on top of it, the first thing you would guess would be the apostles, right? I mean, you would say probably four of the 12. I don't know which ones. Matthew would probably be actually the last one you would guess, which is interesting because you'd be wrong there, right? Matthew wrote one of them. The first two you would probably guess would be, you'd be right on probably one of them. I think we probably would probably be able to guess one of them. That would be who? John, right? And John wrote it. Or John wrote one. So we would be right on him. We'd probably be wrong on Matthew. We'd probably never choose Matthew. Would we choose Luke? Would we choose a Gentile to have written one of these four? Absolutely not. No way. And John Mark, we possibly could guess because we have some... Well, we couldn't guess from reading the Gospels because he's not mentioned. Unless this young man is him, but he's not mentioned as as John Mark. So it'd be hard to decide, but I think one of our top guesses, besides John, would clearly be Peter. Don't you think? It'd be an obvious thing. Now, we clearly have some letters from Peter, which we would expect. But it would seem that one of these Gospels would be Peter's Gospel. And they're not. So I don't want people saying that I'm speculating even more. They're not. This is according to Mark. Mark is the writer of this. I truly believe that. But Mark had a really deep relationship with who? Peter. And Matthew and Mark was which Gospel written? It was the first Gospel. And Matthew and Luke borrowed a lot of their stuff from Mark. They took a lot of the things that are in Mark, some entire passages, and put them in Mark, and they put them in Matthew and Luke. Some of the early church writers call John Mark, Peter's translator. I don't think that's a really good word, because translator means like you're interpreting the language. But what they mean by that is like Peter's scribe, where Mark got a lot of his information from his relationship with Peter. And I think that's probably a pretty good assumption. We know Luke clearly got his information from other people. He said he did. And Mark would have had to. Because John Mark wasn't in the inner circle. He wasn't there for all of these things. He had to get some of his information, and clearly from the Holy Spirit. Obviously, they're all getting their information from the Holy Spirit. But a lot of his information probably came from his discussions with the apostles. And particularly, probably Peter. It's interesting, and I don't think this has probably a whole lot to do with it, but when that young man was captured, that was right at the same time that one of the apostles got really angry and took a sword and did what? Cut the ear off of Malchus, right? Okay? And it's interesting that happened around that same time. And, you know, Mark was the first person to talk about Peter doing that, but he doesn't name Peter. He doesn't say it. He said one of the apostles took a sword and cut the ear off of one of the men that were there. And then Matthew and Luke, when they take that from Mark, which I think they probably did, because very similar language in that particular story, neither of them mentioned that it was Peter either. Because Mark hadn't mentioned it. It's not until we go to John, where John always names Peter. It's interesting. There's an interesting dynamic between John and Peter too. But John mentions Peter and Malchus. And so he gives us some extra stuff that will talk about later when we get to the book of John. But I think it could be plausible. Mark definitely wrote, I think John Mark wrote the book of Mark, but I believe he probably did get a lot of things that he got from Peter. In Acts, in the book of Acts, Peter gives a speech, remember that? And he talks about all the times that Jesus did many miraculous things. And it was a kind of a short speech where all of a sudden Spirit came on Cornelius, right? And that's kind of a short synopsis, and a lot of people think of Mark as being the long version of what Peter was talking about there when he was talking about Jesus and things like that. So I just wanted to throw that out about Peter. Mark, so that's all about John Mark. So who was Mark written to? I believe Mark was written to Christians that were in Rome. We know that John Mark, when he wrote this, probably was in Rome, as we just read. That he was with Paul probably first, and then maybe Peter when he wrote this. And I think it's Roman Christians that he wrote to, not to Jews, because he writes things that Matthew borrows from Mark. He leaves certain things out of that Mark wrote. So like when Matthew's talking to the Jews, he just says things as a matter of fact, like that they would understand what he's talking about. Mark doesn't do that. Really interesting. That's why you kind of know that he wasn't writing to Jews. Because he a lot of times explains things. And there's several passages where he explains things, but this is the overwhelming big one. You probably remember this. It says, "The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were defiled, that is unwashed." And then we have this very strange parenthetical paragraph. "The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles." Right? Why does he say that? You know, I mean, why does he say that? I remember studying Mark in classes before, and people say, "I wonder why he's explaining all that. Wouldn't they know?" Well, he's not writing to the Jews. He's not writing to the Jews. He's writing to Christians, probably in Rome, that really are confused by this Jewish traditions and these things. What does this all mean? You know, they have to kind of understand some of it because Jesus was a Jew. And he came out of that, and so he kind of needed to understand stuff. So there's a lot of explanations in Mark about Jewish traditions and things like this. So this is how we know that this is not written to Jews like Matthew clearly was. So, to end here, what would we not know if it weren't for the writings of Mark? We're going to try to do this in every single book that we do. There's very little. I had to try to really work hard to make it somewhat a bigger list. And there's little things here and there where it's just a different kind of a word or a number. And I try to throw in a couple of those so I could have a list. But everything you find in Mark, you pretty much find in Matthew or Luke. So there's very few things. But here are some that I found somewhat interesting. There is one parable that's only in Mark. It's about a growing seed. And you can read, I won't go through these. Chapter 4, you can look at that. The next one I just threw in there because this morning I was at Martinsdale and Mike Pienick owned pigs, so I thought I'd throw this one in here. Remember when the devils went into the pigs? Right? Mark is the only one that actually gives a rough estimate of how many pigs there were. I'm not sure why he did that, but he did. He says there's about 2,000 pigs. Which is interesting, I thought, because if someone had did a trivia question to me and said, who's the only gospel writer to number the pigs, I would have totally missed this one. I would have said Matthew, right? We talked about Matthew using numbers and different kinds of coinage and things like this because he's a tax collector. But Mark mentions it, and Matthew apparently doesn't include it, so it's interesting. In chapter 6, verse 3, Mark is the only person that refers to Jesus as being a carpenter. The other ones say this is Jesus, the carpenter's son. So we kind of always have assumed anyway from that this is probably his trade that he kind of did as a younger man. But Mark refers to him in chapter 6, verse 3 as Jesus the carpenter. There's two miracles that are unique to Mark. There's so many miracles, and John says, you know, we don't have enough books to hold all of them. So you get a couple different ones in every single book. There's two miracles, and they're easy to remember because of where they're from. There's the deaf man from Decapolis, and there's the blind man from Bethsaida. And those are in chapter 7 and 8, and those are interesting miracles to read. They're a little unique compared to other miracles. In both of these miracles, Jesus uses spit. In both of these miracles, he uses spit, and he puts his fingers on them and touches them. A lot of his miracles, Jesus does works, doesn't he? He says, I must be about my Father's business. There are works. There are things that we must do if we're going to be obedient to Jesus. Of course, the major unique thing that's in Mark, we've already covered, was the story about this young man that in the middle of the night happens to be out in this garden to see all of this. And as I said, I speculate that possibly could have been John Mark himself in chapter 14. One other one that I threw on there that I've always thought was kind of interesting was Simon the Cyrene. Who was he? Remember Simon the Cyrene? He was coming in from the country one day. Happened to be on the day that Jesus was being led up the hill to be crucified. And what did they do to Simon? They grabbed him and they made him carry the cross of Jesus. That's a significant part in your life, I would imagine, if that happened to you. And Mark gives us a lot more information. It's interesting. A lot of these people, they seem to know each other. Mark tells us who this is. Simon the Cyrene and his sons, Rufus and Alexander. They mention, Mark's the only person that mentions that Simon had sons, and here they were. And that's in 1521. And I think that's interesting because Rufus is mentioned again. And I'm not sure how common a name Rufus is, but I would think that it's probably not that common. But in Romans 16:13, Paul says, greet Rufus and his mother, who is like a mother to me. That's what Paul says. Well, Rufus's mother would have been Simon's wife. And Simon's wife was like a mother to Paul? It's very strange. There's a lot of relationships that we just don't really quite know on how they knew each other and how they were related on all these things and these followers of Jesus, how it all worked. And we don't have to know that. It's just interesting to kind of discuss and look around through the scriptures to be able to look for some of these things. So these are the things that are unique to Mark, not very many things, but that's it. So, what's the theme of Mark? Well, no, we got to do this first. We cannot skip. Cannot skip this. I'm sorry. We need to go to the controversial extended ending. Did you know that there was a controversial extended ending in Mark? If you've discussed baptism with people before, then this might have gotten brought up. And I want to cover this because it bothers me. This is one of my pastimes in life where I always wish I could have back. I was discussing baptism with a friend in college, and I had went through all these scriptures on baptism, and there was really no arguments back to him. And then I went to what verse? Mark 16:16, right? And all of a sudden, he came alive and said, oh, well, that's not really actually in the Bible. And because he said it was not really in the Bible, that all these other things on baptism were irrelevant too. And it took me back because if you go to Mark 16, and if you kind of turn there real quick, just to do a little survey here, how many of you find some kind of a parenthetical statement or something like this? Some of you will find it, some of you won't. It's a lot more prevalent now than it was back when I was in college. I didn't have a Bible that said this in here, but now they're starting to stick it in a lot more. The earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have, and keep in mind what it says there, the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have Mark 16:9-20. Why do they stick that in there? What's Mark 16:16 say? Okay, and so if we want to disregard that verse, we can try to say that this whole passage wasn't in there. Now, is it true? Yes. In some of the earliest manuscripts that we have, we don't have this passage. You know, think about it though. I mean, Mark, you know, he wrote this down, right? One book he wrote down. We're lucky to have any of it, really. Think about that. How easy it could have been destroyed. Well, what happens? These things are copied. Other people get copies of these letters. And now we have the internet, so hopefully we'll never lose anything until the internet. There's always a possibility. There's only a finite copies of this written word out there. You know, we had the printing press, and that was even better. That solidified the Bible. It's here forever. We're always going to have it. But you know, there's other passages in other books that in some of the manuscripts that weren't copied over also. And why do they do it? They're cherry picking here. They're just cherry picking on this particular passage. On this one because of what Mark 16:16 says. And I want us to be able to argue this. When someone says, and I wish I could go back in time, because I didn't really have a great argument. I was like, I hadn't even seen that at that time. And then he showed me it, and I was like, you know, I'm not really even sure why that's there or what that means. And I feel like I kind of let it down. I wasn't prepared to have the answer for that. But it says, some other ancient witnesses do not have this. But you know who does have all these verses? Matthew, Luke, and John. Matthew, Luke, and John. Why do we have four of these? So we can answer questions, not smart questions, like this. These are in the other Gospels. And if we want to just look at them real quick, if you want to know these. Whoops. Verses 9 through 11, you can, and we'll just go real fast. 9 through 11, you can find in John chapter 20. It's about Mary Magdalene seeing Jesus. 12 through 13, you can see in Luke 24, that's about when he appears to the two people. In Luke, we find out there are two people on the road to Emmaus. We learn more about it, but that's where you find those two verses. In verse 14, we talk about Jesus appearing before the disciples and being upset with them because they were so unbelieving that it could possibly be him. And we, of course, find that right after the road to Emmaus in the same order that it is here in Mark, in the same order in Luke. And then in 15 through 18, the most important part, because that includes verse 16 about being baptized, where do we find that? We talked about that last time, didn't we? Last chapter of Matthew, very important chapter, Matthew 28, where he sends them out and he says, go and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and teaching them to do all things that I have commanded you. Just like the thing I just commanded you, to be baptized. So, okay, fine. You don't think that this is in here. It's over in Matthew. So let's go over there and read it there. Will that appease you? Will that make you believe? Or are you just going to be blinded, as the Pharisees were blinded, and not accept what the truth is? So we can find that in Matthew 28, and I think we need to be able to be ready with an argument for that. And then in 19 through 20, we find in Luke chapter 24 also. That whole Luke chapter 24 is basically a lot of this Mark, the last part of here in Mark. Okay. What is the theme? What is the theme of Mark? Well, that's kind of a difficult one because Matthew and Luke, you can find pretty much Mark in all of Matthew and Luke. So really, kind of, what is the theme? Well, if you research this and you look in, there's a lot of people that have put a theme on it, and a lot of them kind of agree with it. And it's pretty good, I think, so I'll go with it. I think it's hard to kind of get a particular theme, but a lot of people talk about Mark presenting Christ as the humble servant, that he came to serve the world. And it's a pretty good theme, and of course you would then find that theme in Matthew and Luke, which you do. The word servant's only used in Mark 7 times, so I don't know how it's really overall prevalent theme. But this verse is what people would say is the main verse of Mark. This is a unique verse that here is in Mark that describes the Son of Man in a kind of a different way that he's sometimes normally described. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. We are to be servants of Jesus. And Jesus came to be a servant to us, to lay down his life for us, to be a servant. And if Mark indeed drew a lot of his information from Peter, this would make sense of this being the theme. Because if you go read Peter, a lot of Peter is about servitude. In the second chapter in 1 Peter, it talks about servants, how you're supposed to obey your masters, and you are supposed to find it all joy when you suffer as a servant for Jesus Christ. And Peter even starts his 2 Peter book with Peter, a servant of Jesus Christ. So it does make sense, if Mark did draw from Peter, that this could be a theme, because he would have saw Peter as his mentor, his spiritual mentor, and he would have seen that Peter was a servant. Peter truly was a servant of Jesus Christ, and this is the way we are to be also. So we'll offer the invitation on that note. We need to be servants of Jesus Christ. And the way that we be servant of Jesus Christ is we give ourselves up to him. And the way we do that, which we find in Mark 16 and 16 and in Matthew 28, is that we are buried with him in baptism. It's obedience. This is what it is. We obey him if we are truly going to follow him and be a servant of him. We'll ask that you come forward as we stand and sing.